I'm not sick, but I'm not well. That's Harvey Danger. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Blue Jays are no longer the Flu Jays. They no longer have that illness all around the clubhouse. It's still residually there, but they got everyone back for yesterday's game against the Baltimore Orioles. That does not mean they are well. They squandered a chance to be the first team to sweep the Baltimore Orioles in two full calendar years and a streak of 104 consecutive series splits or wins for the Orioles. They didn't do it because of what we're used to, which is an inability to add on additional runs in a game, and something that has been a little more common this year but has not been particularly common over the last couple of years. It's Jordan Romano letting one go at the back end there. A kind of weird hop single gets a runner on base, and then Adley Rutschman is able to take a pitch for a ride, for a walk-off, two-run home run, give the Orioles the 3-2 victory. It's another off day here for a Blue Jays team and another start back kind of at the drawing board for a Jays team that's 19-23, can't seem to string together consecutive encouraging performances. Yeah, John Schneider can talk about how they held that Orioles team to just 5 runs over 2 games, and that's really encouraging for the pitching staff side, and I would agree. They got good starts from Jose Berríos, who was very sick, from Yusei Kikuchi, who's been great all year. They got electric stuff from Jimmy Garcia out of the bullpen yesterday, but you scored 5 runs over 2 games against the top team in the American League, and that is the team that is half a game back of the top team in the American League. The Yankees have jumped the Orioles right now. That is not going to be enough, and until this offense turns around, we can nitpick some of the bullpen decisions, we can take a closer look at Jordan Romano's performance, and we will do all that. We have a lot of time to fill. But the short of it is, if this team is only going to score 2 or 3 runs a game, if they're going to rank 28th in the major leagues in runs per game, they're not going to win a whole lot of baseball games, and they're certainly not going to string a bunch of victories together. Jays are off today. They'll start a 3-game series with the Rays tomorrow at Rogers Center. It starts a 13-game and 13-day stretch, and what'll probably be the lightest 16-game stretch on the schedule. I know that sounds odd with the Tampa Bay Rays being a part of that, but since they're just 500 right now, just 500, which means they're 4th in the American League East, and that is followed by White Sox, Tigers, White Sox, Pirates. We'll get into all of that. We'll get into some of last night's game as well with our guest, Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score. Before we bring him in, a note that the second segment today, we're going to do some mailbag stuff. So text us 590-590. Let us know what you're feeling. Fire questions our way. We'll go through it all together. Jonah is always going through it, even in good times. How we doing today after that game, buddy?
I'm hanging in there, buddy. How are you?
I'm all right, man. So let's just start at a high level then. I know you were pretty fired up after that game yesterday. There are a lot of kind of micro things we can pick at there, and we can get into that stuff, but high level, how are you feeling after that one?
I mean, how can you feel anything other than dispirited, disheartened, despondent, a lot of disses? I mean, I think the game was just ultimately emblematic of this frustrating season. As you pointed out, their offense gave them no margin for error. What else is new? And despite a strong pitching effort overall, one mistake, one bad pitch from Jordan Romano cost them the game. I suppose it was technically 2 mistakes, because that Adley Rutschman walk-off bomb was preceded by a misplay from IKF that allowed the tying run to reach. But still, their pitching and defense essentially need to be perfect for them to win games. And when they make a mistake or two, or even, like in yesterday's 9th inning, make a couple mistakes in succession, they lose. And while yesterday's loss was particularly gutting because they were 3 outs away from sweeping arguably the best team in the American League on the road, a team that hasn't been swept in 2 calendar years, it was also extremely familiar. 2-for-13 with runners in scoring position, 9 runners left on base. Their 1-2-3 hitters going 2-for-12. It is just the same old story. And with June now 2 weeks away, it's increasingly difficult to feel like this just isn't who they are. Like, this is ultimately the team. We hoped that the huge comeback against Minnesota was an indicator of better things to come. They've scored 6 runs in the 3 games since. Sure, Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. have looked better of late, but ultimately, the Jays still scored 3 runs or fewer in 7 of their 11 games this month. And consequently, this team hasn't won consecutive games since April. They haven't won more than 2 consecutive games in a month. And at this point, just getting back to 500 feels like a Sisyphean task. And meanwhile, as we're straining to see the silver linings, like Bo's improved hitting or Alek Manoah's most recent start, the rest of the American League and the rest of the American League East keeps winning games. So yeah, I mean, yesterday's loss did get me fired up because it epitomized everything about this eminently frustrating team. And ultimately, it's hard to be bullish about the Jays right now, not only because of their current position in the AL postseason picture, but also just both observationally and via the underlying numbers, they just don't look like a championship team.
They don't look like a championship team. They barely look like a playoff team. And the only thing that would keep you saying that they do look like a playoff team is they have four really good starting pitchers still. And that can do stuff for you sometimes that can get you there, even if the rest of the team is kicking and screaming on the way there, like the offense has so far. So a lot to dig in there, Jonah. A couple things on top of that. Not only did they strand nine runners yesterday, six of those runners got stranded in scoring position. Additionally frustrating. And you look at the 2-for-13 with runners in scoring position. The Orioles went 0-for-10, but the ability to hit a home run goes a long way. That's something the Blue Jays also haven't done. They are near the very bottom of the league in home runs hit. They are near the very top of the league in home runs allowed. That is a pretty bad formula for winning baseball games here in 2024. So let's get into some of the specifics from this one. I think that was a good high level check in on where we're feeling, probably also where the fan base is feeling. Like, you don't want to, you know, you're not doing standings watch every day on May 16th, but you are already five games out of a wild card spot and nine games back in a division. And that would be one thing if there was one team ahead of you, but everyone is ahead of you. You have the entire league that you have to make up ground on. In addition, like you said, some of the underlying metrics really dispiriting. That minus 47 run differential is the fifth worst in all of baseball. You're 28th in runs per game. You're 28th in bullpen ERA. And even that really vaunted starting rotation, which has continued to trend in the right direction, and obviously there's a lot of track record there for those guys, you're 17th in starter ERA. It's not, you know, this isn't your 1-2-3 in starter ERA so far. So a lot to be discouraged about, a lot to be worried about. And yeah, look, this is the time where they kind of have to turn it around. And we'll talk about this 16 game set ahead in a minute here. But if you're not going to do it when you get the lightest part of your schedule, and look, I'm not saying that if you beat up on the White Sox and Tigers and Pirates, everyone's going to be like, the Blue Jays are back. Like, but this is your chance to get back to 500 over these next couple weeks. And if it doesn't happen then, they haven't been five games under 500 since the final game of the 2019 season. And they're right there. They're one loss away from it. So it's pretty tough. Okay, so let's get into some of the micro stuff from this game last night before we look ahead to this kind of this very pivotal 16-game stretch. Let's start on the hitting side where they can't score. And yes, the bullpen blew that game. We'll talk about Jordan Romano. We'll talk about some of the decisions within that. But high level, you're probably not winning a lot of baseball games scoring two runs. It's not a fair ask of your pitching staff anyway. You mentioned the top of the batting order. We've done a lot of the George Springer stuff. Are you buying that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette are turning it around here? Vlad ranks top five in the American League in batting average and on base percentage over the last month. Bo has 10 hits in his last six games here. I don't want to, you know, turn a negative into a positive where there isn't one, but things are going to flow through how Vlad and Bo do. Are you buying it a little bit that those two guys are at least finding their footing?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly encouraging what we've seen, particularly from Bo Bichette. I really feel as though his swing decisions have improved meaningfully of late. There was a point there in late April, early May, where it seemed like in an effort to hoist himself out of his early season funk, he just started hacking at everything, but he's cut that out recently. Over the last week or so, he hasn't been chasing nearly as much, and he simultaneously started offering at pitches in the strike zone with greater consistency, and the results speak for themselves. More pulled balls, more quality contact, more base hits. So the improved swing decisions for Bo are certainly a reason for optimism moving forward. But also, when we spoke a few weeks ago, Blake, I mentioned that it was only a matter of time before the hits started falling in for him, and that wasn't just a throwaway line. Through his first 33 games this year, Bo's batting average on balls in play was .219. which was one of the lowest in all of baseball, certainly the lowest on the Jays, lower than Alejandro Kirk, who needs a very specific kind of batted ball in order to leg out a hit. That's pretty telling. So that figure was bound to normalize for Bo, even though his contact quality early on wasn't great, and it has normalized. Over his last half dozen games, His BABIP is 500, so it's actually more than normalized. And look, this uneven season isn't out of the norm. We all remember how Bo's 2022 campaign went. He's been a streaky hitter at times throughout his career, both process-wise and results-wise, but the numbers are always there at season's end, and I think they will be this year, too. Certainly the last half dozen games have been outstanding. Now, as for Vlad, I see some similarities between his heater and Bo's, but they're maybe not as encouraging. He has been chasing less of late. I'll give him that, and it feels like we haven't seen nearly as many of those gruesome swings where he flails at soft stuff low and away lately. But honestly, what stands out the most to me about Vlad's turnaround is that he's running a 500 BABIP since late April, despite no meaningful improvement in his contact quality from earlier this year. His hard contact rate over the last 2+ weeks is virtually identical to what it was from opening day through mid-April. Same goes with his pull rate. That hasn't meaningfully changed. And while he is elevating the baseball a bit more, he's still not doing it with nearly enough regularity. And that's part of the reason why, even though he's got an OPS of 970 since April 27th, he also has one home run and three doubles over that span. His isolated power is barely over 100 over the course of this heater. So it's been Kirkian, if I may. Look, don't get me wrong. Hits are hits. OPSing almost 1,000 is great. But process-wise and batted ball-wise, I'm not seeing a dramatically different Vlad now than I was earlier this year.
Yeah, some of the, you know, and of course we have to take exit velocities and things like that in the context of how the ball is hit and where the ball is hit and things like that. Vlad could probably hit 400 the rest of the way and people would still be like, well, we need some home runs out of him because this team, again, has been near the very bottom of the league in home runs hit and near the very top of the league in home runs allowed. There are 86 players in Major League Baseball who would rank first or second on the Blue Jays in home runs and who do not play for the Toronto Blue Jays. That list includes Paul DeYoung, by the way.
Blue Jays legend.
Yes, Blue Jays legend. By the way, let's use that to pivot to another spot in the lineup. So there are a couple things we could pick at lineup-wise. I think, you know, I'm mostly in agreement with you on, hey, we all thought Bo Bichette would find it from a hitting for contact perspective. He's a streaky guy. Vlad, it's nice to see this turnaround, but you're going to need to see some of that hard hit contact go in the air a little bit more. They need, even if this is an improvement, they need him to be a big damage guy, not just an on-base guy. And then the other question would be, okay, well, George Springer, when's he moving down in the order? We don't need to do that again. Every guest on this show we've done it with at this point, it's going to be a season-long discussion. And what that did yesterday was Springer being back at the top of the order meant Jansen and Schneider were 5-6, the team's two best hitters so far this year. No hits between them yesterday, but 3 walks. So at least some good process stuff there. And then there's Daniel Vogelbach. And maybe he was in there because Justin Turner wasn't 100%. Maybe he was in there because they liked something with the Kyle Bradish matchup, righty on lefty. And he does work long plate appearances. He can take a walk, etc. But, you know, yesterday, again, you use the word emblematic for the team game. Daniel Vogelbach gets up 3-0 and then works a quality out. And the game before that, he had got a loop single that scored a run that felt merciful. That one dropped in. Look, everyone seems to really like having Daniel Vogelbach around. A very smart guy, very good approach at the plate. But the hits have continued to not be there. He's hitting .111. He has a .405 OPS. And of course, if he gets on base, you're thinking immediately to pinch run for him. There's no defensive position for him. I know they paid him $2 million. Where is your patience level or even your level of utility with Daniel Vogelbach as kind of this team's 26th man right now? When they, you know, the guy who's supposed to be an offensive package specialist has been probably the worst hitter on the team.
Yeah, I mean, my patience, I think it's been exhausted. Look, when your stars aren't producing, it's even more essential that your role players are providing value. And while there are plenty of role players on this team who are disappointing at the moment, none have provided less value than Daniel Vogelbach. Look, I get that it's hard to get into a rhythm at the plate when you play as infrequently as he does, but he rarely plays because, as you pointed out, he's such a liability everywhere outside of the batter's box. And the problem is, he's also been pretty useless in the batter's box this year. Like you said, he's hitting .111. He has 0 home runs. It's the middle of May. And I ultimately think it's time for that experiment to end. Look, when we talked on opening day, I thought that rostering Vogelbach over Joey Votto, over Spencer Horowitz, was the right call. He had the better track record, at least recently, of hitting right-handed pitching. That was the manner in which they were going to deploy him exclusively. It made sense. But now, given how he struggled and how desperately this lineup needs a boost, it's time, in my estimation, to pivot. It's time to call up Spencer Horowitz, who is absolutely raking in AAA, an OPS of almost 950. It's time to call up if you want Aurelvis Martinez, who is the youngest player on Buffalo's roster. He has the most home runs on the team. He's OPSing almost 900. But in any event, I think it's time for Vogelback to go. And look, I mean, you mentioned the fact that he can work a walk, that he walks long, that he works long plate appearances. He never swings the bat. He has the lowest swing rate among hitters with 40 plate appearances this year. It feels like to me, in many instances, he goes up there looking to walk. And that's just not what, you know, this team needs. They need someone in the middle of their lineup who's going to do damage, not a guy who is a liability on the base paths, who's up there looking to walk. And who isn't even, you know, terribly effective at getting on base. So, look, it was the right call at the time. And I think now it's plainly obvious that they need to move in a different direction.
Yeah, they'd run into as well with Vogelbach if the sample got large enough. If you're not doing damage, you know, you can have the best eye in the world, but pitchers are just going to start throwing it into the zone to you. This has been like the Kevin Biggio up and down over the years of, you know, as soon as the OBP starts to approach like 380, then pitchers are like, okay, well, he's going up there with the bat on his shoulders, and then he has to counter adjust, and he's done a pretty good job over time the last couple weeks here, excluded. So Vogelbach also, look, he's in rare territory here as a Blue Jay. So for anyone who forgets, he had a stint with the Blue Jays back in 2020. He went 0-for-4 with a walk. He was claimed off of waivers 10 days after the Blue Jays purchased him, and he ended up having an okay season and change with the Brewers, like a 100 OPS plus, which if you're a DH who needs to be pinch run for, that's probably right around where you're on the DFA bar. Do you remember who the Blue Jays acquired that required the Daniel Vogelbach release?
Oh, my goodness.
Trade deadline 2020.
2020 trade deadline? Was it Taiwan Walker?
So there were a series of moves, but on the position player side, it was Jonathan Villar. They also acquired Taiwan Walker, Robbie Ray, and Ross Stripling at that deadline. So a lot of churn there. So you mentioned, by the way, do you want to do the who's worse on the all-time OPS plus Jays register?
Oh, I would love to.
So yeah. you know who the worst is, right?
All time? How many appearances minimum?
I said it at 25.
25,
which is about how many letters he has in his name.
So it's not Paul DeJong. It's got to be Jared Saltalamacchia.
Yes, Paul DeJong second. Jared Saltalamacchia and Paul DeJong, by the way. So this is minimum 25 plate appearances in your career as a Blue Jay. Those are the two lowest OPS pluses. Those are lower than Roy Halladay's, who got 41 plate appearances as a Blue Jay and had a 158 OPS, higher than DeJong and Saltalamacchia. The only other guys with more plate appearances than Vogelbach who appear lower on this list so far are Corey Snyder, who had a cup of coffee in 1991, Joe Cannon in 1979, 1980, and Alan Hansen, another Blue Jays legend who had a quick cup of coffee back in 2019. And
if I recall correctly, sorry to interrupt you, Blake, Alan Hansen pinch ran for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in Vlad's debut after he hit that ninth inning double against Oakland. I think that's Alan Hansen's signature moment in a Blue Jays uniform, was pinch running for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
Wow. On April 20th.
Yeah.
That's a good pull, man. If you have any good pulls, by the way, not to be overly negative, you can text us into 590, 590. We're going to spend the second segment taking some of your questions and comments. And maybe if you just want to remember some guys who had really bad short Blue Jays stints, Socrates Brito, another name on that list that I'm sure everyone is eager to remember the Socrates Brito era. Okay, so Jonah, you mentioned Spencer Horwitz as the primary option to come up from Buffalo. If anyone hasn't been keeping up, he's hitting .331 down there. He has a .461 on base percentage, a slugging of .476. So not a ton of extra power there on top of the batting average, but he does have 15 doubles in just 38 games. He's taken almost a walk a game and walked more than he struck out. They've been playing him a little bit in left field, a little bit at second base. You know, I went back and watched a little bit of him trying to turn two at second base. He turned it. It didn't look like the smoothest turn you've ever seen. But you know, they're clearly trying to find different ways they could find his a way to him in the lineup. With Aurelvis Martinez, the power is there. That's more of a game-changing bat. I understand them being a little bit more patient there, given he's one of the youngest players at AAA still, and you don't want that guy to come up and sit on the bench too often. But with Spencer Horwitz, he's 26. this is year two or three of him being this kind of guy in the minor leagues. You know, you don't want to put an artificial ceiling on a guy, but if a 26-year-old is going to come up and only play a couple days a week because he's a first baseman slash DH and you have Vladimir Guerrero and Justin Turner, I don't think that's the same conversation as Aurelvis or even Addison Barger sitting on the bench, right? Like Spencer Horwitz at this point in his prospect life cycle could come up and be a bench bat, and that's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Look at what Baltimore did with Heston Kjerstad, right? They just recently optioned him back down, but he's a highly touted prospect, even younger than Horowitz. They brought him up and he wasn't even in the lineup every day. So, they were maximizing, their optimization of their active roster over his development. And, he was much more of a prospect than Spencer Horowitz is at this point in his career. Look, he has nothing left to prove at AAA. I don't think you're going to do any damage developmentally to have him come up, play infrequently, or even struggle at the big league level. And there's nothing else that he can do offensively to demonstrate that he is ready for the challenge of facing major league pitching. Even last year when he came up, he was effective. No, he didn't hit for much power. I believe he only hit one home run, but he put up quality at bats. He took a lot of walks. The OBP was there. He's absolutely the kind of candidate that you give a shot to, especially he's already on the 40-man roster. It's such a seamless move that I really don't see any downside in bringing him up, giving him a shot, and maybe you catch lightning in a bottle. Maybe he becomes a really meaningful role player for a team that's really desperate for anyone to step up and contribute offensively.
Yeah, and look, the 26 roster spot right now, and again, I know they like having Vogelbach around. He seems like a good guy. He has a track record of good plate appearances and stuff like that. He hasn't got it done, and that's kind of what you have to do in that spot. And Spencer Horwitz, I mean, he's probably got to be thinking a little bit, like, what else do I have to do to get a shot at this point? And who knows? I don't know. Like, there's a scenario where, okay, well, maybe he turns into, like, a different version of Vogelbach, and his upside is maybe still, like who knows? You don't want to artificially cap it, but maybe he turns out to be just, like, a solid bench bat. It's good to get in there and find that out now, and also he would make the league minimum while he's up, so it's a more efficient way to find that bench bat generally. So maybe that's
and
something.
Moreover, if I may add, Blake, even if he is a facsimile of Vogelbach in terms of what he produces offensively, he's not a player that you need to manage around because he's not a liability in the field. He can play a good first base, and he's not a liability on the base pass. So he's I see the downside risk as he is Vogelbach, except not nearly as big of a challenge managerially.
Yeah, and he's stolen a couple bases this year. You're not going to ask him to do that at the major league level, but if you wanted a proxy for this guy isn't an issue on the base paths, the fact that a first baseman DH type has stolen a couple bases, has played some left field and second base, I think it's time to give Spencer Horwitz a shot here. Maybe that would put the Blue Jays in a position where their bullpen and their starters don't have to be perfect every single time out, like they had to be yesterday. So before we get into the negatives here, Jimmy Garcia came into a spot in that game yesterday. Runners on second and third, nobody out for the top of the Baltimore Orioles order. Even before controlling for just how good the top of the order is, average level of competition coming up to the plate, the Orioles at that point, despite trailing, had a 66% chance of winning that game because you've got two men in scoring position, nobody's out, there's no force out on the diamond, anything like that. Your odds of getting multiple runs in that spot are really, really strong. 66%. When Jimmy Garcia left that inning, it was down to 24%. I know people don't love win probability added. I sometimes like it to highlight how high a leverage situation is for a reliever. And in this case, Jimmy Garcia came into basically the highest leverage spot you could have in terms of quality of lineup and bad situation in a one-run game, and was absolute nails. He then comes back out and is good again, gets that terrific play from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. on the James McCann bunt up the line. And yeah, Vlad maybe could have let it go foul to be safe, but that's a snap decision that, what if that dies fair and you just conceded the tying run? Really, really great stuff from Jimmy Garcia. I don't think even after yesterday, there's any conversation that he would supplant Jordan Romano as the closer. But just where are you at on Jimmy Garcia as a fireman that can come in second and third, top of the order in an early inning, 10th inning if Jordan Romano's not available, ninth save situation if Jordan Romano's not available. Like, the trust level for me could not be higher on Jimmy Garcia right now.
No, it simply couldn't. He is simply put, one of the best relievers in all of baseball right now. And I tell you one thing, Jimmy Garcia is going to net the Blue Jays a nice haul at the trade deadline if their season and his keep going like they've been going. I mean, what else can you say? The guy misses 2 weeks with a bad back, comes back, and immediately resumes being, like I said, one of the best relievers in all of baseball through 16 appearances. Both his ERA and his WHIP are below 0.6. One inning, multiple innings like yesterday, it doesn't matter. He's just unhittable right now, and that's not hyperbole. He's given up 5 hits in 17 innings, which is just mind-boggling. It's scary to think where the Blue Jays would be without him. I mean, he's already bailed them out of so many tight spots, and by win probability added, he's been the most valuable player on the team. Not pitcher, the most valuable player on the team. He has 9 shutdowns, which is as many as Jordan Romano, Chad Green, and Nate Pearson combined. You simply can't say enough about what Jimmy Garcia has done this year, the reinvention that he's done, you know, not only in somehow increasing his velocity in his early 30s, but also, you know, adding a new sweeper, deepening his repertoire. He's just nasty. And like you said, you have ultimate confidence in him that he'll get you out of whatever situation he may inherit when he takes the mound.
You mentioned his WHIP there. He has allowed 10 base runners in 17 innings so far. 3 of those were intentional walks based on the situation.
Wild. Also, intentional walks should not count against a pitcher's WHIP.
No, it's a managerial decision. Yeah. But having said that, this isn't a Jimmy Garcia thing. This is more of an Alec Manoah and some other guys thing. A hit by a pitch should count toward your WHIP.
Yes, it should.
We need to tweak some of these stats. But yeah, 7 base runners in 17 innings that weren't called for by John Schneider. It's ridiculous. Would you have, this is nitpicky because Tim Mesa got out of the situation, but you've got Jimmy Garcia there against Kyle Stowers. They opt for Tim Mesa instead, which gets Ramon Urias in the game instead. Garcia had thrown 17 pitches at that point, all of them like very high stress. You okay with that move? I think I would have rolled with it with Jimmy Garcia, but Mays obviously did the job.
Mays got the job done. I would have left the best reliever on the team in there, especially given how he was throwing, but tip your hat to John Schneider. It worked out.
The other thing that also worked out, but you could take a question with, Yusei Kikuchi got taken out in the 5th inning of that one. He had not been particularly pitch efficient. He talked about it after the game and basically said through translator, and I'm paraphrasing here, but basically that was such a competitive game. That's such a tough team. He was okay with the pitch count going up because he felt he had to pitch his absolute best. And if that meant more pitches, then that meant more pitches. They did take him out in the 5th around 90 pitches there. What did you make of that one? Would you have let him go a little bit? Zach Pop, again, he comes in and he gets Mountcastle chasing and then a loud-ish out from Gunnar Henderson there.
Loud indeed. If you have the old left field dimensions at Camden Yards, maybe it's a different story. But yeah, I mean, I was surprised by that move. I appreciate that it was Kikuchi's second time through the lineup. But even though he wasn't his most economical, I did think that he was pitching well. And that looming Pop versus Henderson matchup is not really ideal. And more broadly, I think Kikuchi has earned more rope. He's arguably the best starter in this rotation. He's increasingly one of the better starters in the American League, if not all of baseball. And I just think I would have preferred him to go through the middle of Baltimore's lineup there over Pop the third time through, the order penalty notwithstanding. And plus, taking him out of the game that early means you're asking for almost 5 innings out of your bullpen, which, you know, even with this group being rested and with no game today, that's a tall task. Was it an indefensible move? No, certainly not. It's just not what I would have done. It worked out. Pop not only got out of the inning unscathed, but he looked terrific over the course of his outing. But yeah, I would have figured that Yusei Kikuchi would have been given the opportunity to work his way out of that.
So 5 relievers pitch yesterday, but it's sandwiched with off days on either side. The Jays have now had 5 off days in 15 days. Jonah, we better not hear about a thin bullpen this weekend. I can't, maybe later in this 13 game and 13 day stretch, but I don't want to hear about a thin bullpen for a little bit. So it is 13 games in 13 days starting tomorrow. We found out yesterday that the Jays have decided not to change Alec Manoah's landing spot there. They're going to start him Sunday against the Rays. So what that'll mean is if Manoah stays in the rotation and everyone continues on turn during this 13 game stretch, and then looking ahead to the Pittsburgh series after an off day as well, Manoah will face Tampa Bay, Detroit, and the White Sox instead of White Sox, Tigers, Pirates. So really, I mean, he's still going to get the White Sox in there, still going to get the Tigers in there. It's a Tampa Bay for Pittsburgh swap out if they don't change things up. How did you feel about that decision? there's an argument to be made that you wanted him against the White Sox instead for kind of a softer next step, but also an argument to be made that if you're going to be doing those things and juggling the rotation to protect him, maybe that doesn't say a lot of good things about your confidence level in him.
Yeah, and I think that's where I lean as well, is that if you need to ensure that he has a soft landing every time out, then he's probably not a guy who should be in a rotation for a team that's trying to make the playoffs. I have no problem with them structuring their rotation like this. And I thought he actually looked really sharp his last time out. He should have gotten out of that outing with no damage done. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, and he served up that home run to Carlos Santana. But look, at the end of the day, if this team is going to go where they hope it's going to go, they need Manoah to pitch effectively, and they can't be worrying every time out, oh, is this the optimal matchup for him? Is this an opponent that he doesn't match up well against? If he's in the rotation, he's in the rotation, right? And he's not going to be coddled, and I think that that's the right move. And hopefully he can continue to build on what we saw from his last time out and continue to recapture at least some of the success that he enjoyed earlier in his career.
Doing it this way also, spreads out those extra bits of rest that the off days have provided. I mentioned 5 off days in a 15-day stretch. As they take their next turns, Chris Bassitt will have had 8 days of rest. Gausman and Manoah and Berríos all 7, Kikuchi 6. So some good extra rest built in there. It's done because you're going to play 13 and 13 here. So this stretch that's ahead, Jonah, and this is maybe one day too early for this question, but we're not going to talk to you tomorrow. So they play 3 at home against the Rays. The Rays are 22-22. They are a below average offense, but more notably, they're 2nd in home runs surrendered. They've had some trouble on the pitching side. Then there are 3 at home against the White Sox, who are 14-30 and dead last in offense by a significant margin before the second to last team. They'll then play 4 at Detroit. Nice little start, 21-22, a team that I was high on as a team that could maybe take that step to 500-ish territory this season. But again, a bottom 10 offense. 3 against the White Sox again, 3 against Pittsburgh, who are 19-25, have a couple of cool arms in the starting rotation, but are bottom 5 in offense. This is a stretch of 16 straight games against teams 500 or lower, all with below average offenses. The Jays would have to go 10-6 over this stretch to finish that chunk of the schedule back at 500. Getting back to 500 after that stretch of play feels like a really low bar, and you still have to go 10-6 to do it. Where are you at in terms of what they need to do over this 16 game stretch? Again, acknowledging that the Rays are probably better than 22-22, but we're chunking them in here because that's the stretch that starts Friday. How do the Jays need to come out of this 16 game window?
Well, I would say shooting for 500 is the bare minimum, and I'll kind of sidestep your question in a way and say that this stretch to me only presents an opportunity for the Blue Jays to reinforce the idea that they are perhaps not a legitimate World Series contender. Because if they emerge from this at 500, you're saying, yeah, of course they went 10-6 against these bottom of the barrel, terrible teams. But if they go 8-8, you're saying, oh yeah, we knew that this Blue Jays team didn't have the offense, didn't have the ability to go better than 500 against the league's foremost cellar dwellers. So I think this is a really fraught 16 games insofar as playing teams like the White Sox and Detroit can be fraught. But yeah, this is going to be a telling revelatory stretch here for the Blue Jays. And I think it's going to give us perhaps the critical piece of evidence as to whether they are legit or whether they are paper tigers.
Yeah, and look, for anyone who's raising their hands up and saying, well, who cares if you beat up those bottom teams, we're not saying that that would mean the Blue Jays are good and fixed and back and all those things. But if you are going to use the logic in June of, and especially in July, of, well, we're around 500, and if you're around 500 at the midway point, anything can happen. Look at Arizona, look at Philly, etc. over the last couple of years. Now, those teams also don't play in the American League East. But, generally teams feel if you're built to win and you're around 500 at the midway point, you're going to give yourself some runway to figure it out and continue to try. If you come out of this stretch and you're looking down June and then you're looking down July and the easiest chunk of your schedule is behind you and you're still under 500, it's going to look very, very bleak. And Jonah, the next time we have you on, maybe we are talking about that. What could you get for Jimmy Garcia topic much more seriously than just, hey, this is a not even a silver lining. I don't know what is less good than a silver lining. But like right now, that is something to acknowledge. If they come out of this stretch and they're still struggling below 500 and they've looked bad against, or they've looked just okay against some of the worst teams in the league, yeah, those conversations are really going to pick up. And the question of the season might then become, well, is it a sell or is it a retool for 2025? That's how urgent these couple of weeks feel to me. And I think it says a lot about the way this season has gone that games against the White Sox, Tigers, and Pirates feel big.
Yeah, they don't fill you with optimism. They fill you with dread. It's like, are we going to expose, you know, are the Blue Jays going to expose themselves as on the same level as these teams? It's a truly critical stretch. And look, the Blue Jays to date have had the hardest schedule in all of Major League Baseball. If you look at Baseball Reference's strength of schedule metric, it's the Blue Jays. And if you look at, you know, even more advanced stuff on sort of a pitching caliber level, you know, stuff plus, the Blue Jays have faced some of the toughest pitching in the league so far. So, you know, maybe that does favorably contextualize their struggles to date. But over the next 16 games, we're going to see. We're going to see if, you know, this team is genuinely capable of being an above average offensive team, or if, what we've seen over the first 6 weeks of the season are indeed indicative of what this team is. But it doesn't feel good to say that going into the softest stretch of the schedule, you're like a little bit uptight, but that's the reality of the 2024 Blue Jays right now.
This is supposed to be the part of the schedule where you add gravy. You improve the record just for the sake of it, and you gain a couple games because it's easier. Not, hey, you got to pull this thing out of the drain. Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score, thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
Thanks, pal. Good to see you.
Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score. I would imagine him and I will be at one of the games during this little homestand. Melting down. If things continue to go this way, Jays off today. They'll get back in action tomorrow against the Rays. Bassett, Gausman, Manoah, Tampa Bay have not announced their starters for that series yet, but it's expected to be Tyler Alexander, Zach Eflin, Aaron Civale. So that's a Rays team that has given up a lot of home runs, but the Jays don't hit those. So be interesting to see the opposite of immovable force against irresistible object, et cetera. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take some of your questions in the text line, 590-590. What are you curious about right now? What are you stressed about most? Hit us with your questions and comments, 590-590. Mailbag's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Going to answer some of your mailbag questions to 590-590. You could text in, leave your name and location for the remainder of today's show. Before we do that, wanted to take a moment to offer condolences to the family and friends and everyone over at TSN. SportsCenter host Darren Detition passed away yesterday. TSN announced this morning. He, for a lot of people in Canada, is the voice of the highlight package. In the morning, certainly inextricable from a lot of my sports watching memories, waking up before school and checking the highlights before you go in, and then getting the chance to meet him a small handful of times once I got into the industry. Tremendous person, tremendous energy. Our thoughts and condolences go out to his family and the whole family over at TSN. Pivoting to the mailbag here again, you can text questions into 590-590. If we don't get to them today, we'll hold them for sometime in the future. You guys are fired up today. Who should fire this person, fire that person? Why is this person any good, et cetera? Look, that stuff's fun, and the Jays are in a bad way here. And I'd have to imagine, honestly, a little surprised with 5 off days in 15 days and the cover of the Leafs being eliminated and making a coaching change and having a really, really poor PR-focused press conference, that you didn't sneak any of those moves and any of that news in under the cover of that. Okay. So we'll do some of that stuff. Brian in Toronto asks, do I see a move as imminent as today or tomorrow, starting with John Schneider. I think, you know, weirdly, like it would have happened over the course of this trip if it was going to happen. I guess with an off day today, you could do that. And this is the start of 13-13. You're back home, et cetera. I don't know that John Schneider would be the move either. I know people, you know, haven't liked some of his moves, George Springer staying atop the lineup. I don't know how much he would be able to, I don't know how much he's responsible for the fact that Vlad, Bo, and Springer are all off to lesser starts. You know, his bullpen usage has been fine-ish if you accept the caveat that no one back there except for Jimmy Garcia and Trevor Richards have been particularly good. I just think more than anything, that question is going to need to be answered one level higher than John Schneider. And if you decide you're going to make a change in that spot, you make a new person in that role, the person who gets to decide on the future of John Schneider. Also, the Jays did that 2 years ago with Charlie Montoya, and it really didn't make a difference. You got like a 2 week bump, and then they went back to being who they were. I don't know that they'll do that again. Steve from St. Thomas, shout out to St. Thomas, great little city, says, I would like to say the last four games going back to the comeback win against the Twins have been a lot more fun to watch. Hopefully that's a turning point and we see it as such in a few weeks. I hope you're right, Steve. Saturday's game and Monday's game were certainly a lot of fun. The two losses in there were very playoff style losses. I think I would appreciate those losses a lot more if the Jays were a couple games above 500 versus a couple games under. It's tough to appreciate those quite as much when the team's playing poorly. By the way, speaking of yesterday's game, and first of all, that it felt playoffy and then also just a rare one, Expo fan in sent a DM question and asked if I can remember a time where a team opened and ended the game with home runs and didn't score at all in between. I can't think of one off my head, but a cool note that the Orioles did do that. They got a leadoff homer and a walk-off homer and absolutely nothing in between. Baseball always finds ways somehow of giving you things that maybe aren't new, but that you can't remember seeing before. Mark in Cambridge, 519, region representation, says, if the Jays re-sign Bo long-term, bracket, which they should, do you think he's more likely to eventually slide to second or third as he ages? I'd say second base there. Some of that might be determined by, you know, who else is around and what's in the pipeline. But given the fact that if there were complaints about Bo's defense at shortstop in the past, it was more on the arm side than the range side, I would think the second base move would be a little bit easier for him. A corner outfield, always a possibility as well, although you wouldn't be able to stomach the valleys at the plate like he started this season with as well in a corner outfield spot. Frank in Peterborough says, aside from Vladdy and Bo, who's most likely to turn their season around at the plate? That's a good question. There aren't, unfortunately, a lot of good answers there. George Springer is the guy people would point to, I think, and certainly hope about. And I don't think he's going to continue with a 277 OBP and a 295 slugging. But I think the days of a 750, 775 OPS from Springer are probably behind us, unfortunately. So I guess my answer here, and this will be a smaller one because it's in a part-time role, but I think Kevin Biggio has better days ahead. The process there has been good enough over the years. He's been able to figure out each time he kind of heads into a spell. So the fact that he has a 596 OPS right now, I think as the season goes on and he finds his way back into more opportunities, he'll heat up and be a little bit better. I wish I had more confidence that George Springer will get back to, you know, 775 OPS George Springer, but I would need to see it for a sustained stretch at this point. Alan London says, why is everyone loving Varsho? Great D, who cares? He's batting 208. Don't you agree? Offense always trumps defense. My actual answer to this is those things don't have to be mutually exclusive. You could be good at defense and offense. There are lots of players around baseball who do both. Having said that, one, Dalton Varsho is, by the way we can measure it, the best defensive outfielder in baseball. So if you are, you know, whether you are a numbers person or a traditionalist, excellent outfield defense plays. And that's an important thing. That's a fun thing to watch. Varsho, also a quality guy on the base paths. I know he's only hitting 208. He's never going to be a high on base guy either. His on base is 304 right now, which would be the second highest of his career. He also leads the team in home runs, is the only guy who's put, you know, any sustained power stretch into this season. He's also second on the team in stolen bases. There's a lot going on there with Varsho beyond just the batting average. You know, I think listeners know I'm a guy who values on base percentage. So if Varsho has a 304 on base percentage and I'm still advocating for him being a plus player, I think that tells you enough about the D and the value of, look, those seven home runs. It's not like he's on pace for 50, but this team needs power so desperately. Now, you can make the case maybe he shouldn't be hitting in the two hole with that kind of on base percentage, but there are just not a lot of options to hit high in this Blue Jays order right now, or at least not ones they're going to explore. David Schneider should be up there more regularly, though. Graham asks, rather than firing Schneider, would it make more sense to look at Mattingly being replaced? That's a hard one to answer just because the offensive coordinator role is a little vague. And, you know, there are also, you know, do you put it on Mattingly? Do you put it on Schneider? There are a handful of hitting coaches as well. It is a little bit of a black box of who is responsible for what specifically. I do think that that note, Graham, is indicative of the fact that there's no obvious in-house solution if you did move on from Schneider. Don Mattingly has coordinated the offense. The offense hasn't been particularly good. He does have a Manager of the Year award in his past, but he's also had a shaky track record overall. DeMarlo Hale also around. I just think, Graham, the more to the point of this is there are so many voices involved in there. It is a little hard to get specific with who is to blame or to credit with each specific thing. But yeah, I think the bigger takeaway there is that there is a collective struggle going on right now with those things. Nick from London asks, how do the Jays handle the imminent returns of Francis and Rodriguez? Okay, so this one is, in terms of imminent, I think that that is more accurate for Bowden Francis. He had that rehab start Tuesday at AAA, looked really good. I don't know if they're going to send him for another one. I watched those innings. He looked good enough to be facing major league hitting at this point. So I would guess he slots into that bullpen pretty comfortably. There are a handful of guys in that bullpen who have options. Hennessy Cabrera, Zach Pop, Nate Pearson. Pop has probably overperformed what you were expecting here on the call-up, and I think he's probably done enough to stay. I might be tempted to send Cabrera down as the corresponding move. He struggled a little bit and really struggled with finding the strike zone. Also hasn't missed a ton of bats. I know they value having a second lefty in there, but you have Trevor Richards, who you trust as kind of a pseudo to lefties guy because of that changeup. I think you could probably do that. Nate Pearson also has an ERA over 5 and has options. With respect to Yariel Rodriguez, he is less close. He was supposed to throw again in Toronto this week, but we don't have a timeline in terms of when he's going to get on a rehab outing and things like that. So I'll use a Dan Schulmanism with someone who's more than a couple days away and say these things have a way of working themselves out. Maybe someone needs an IL stint by that time. Sam and Wally, one of these is in Ontario, one of these is in St. John's. My dad's here from Newfoundland right now. Look forward to seeing him on the weekend. So shout out to St. John's. Why have we not heard anything about Joey Votto? Because there's not really an update. He's started expanding his hitting, his fielding, his running, but he still hasn't gotten into live action. He's told the Blue Jays he wants to be 100% before he gets into live game action, starts a rehab assignment, things like that. So he's not there yet. I know it's weird. He rolled that ankle in his first plate appearance months ago now. But yeah, he's going to make sure he's 100%, 1,000% before he gets back in game action, still down at the complex, you know, hitting off a tee, doing fielding work, things like that. Josh and Barry asks, if you were adding a big bat to the lineup, what position would you target? I don't think you can be picky. A corner outfield, second base, third base, even someone who could chip in at the DH spot a little bit more. Would Oakland move off of a Brent Rooker who is older as a prospect, so the years of control aren't maybe not as valuable? I don't know. That's kind of, at this point, it's an any port in a storm kind of thing where, you got to get offense in here, and you do have a couple non-everyday positions. So whether it ends up being left field, second base, third base, someone who can dart around to different spots, I don't think you have to worry about it that much, Josh. You just need a little more offense in here, which is why the conversation around why not call one of these kids up from AAA for a little extra boost is a relevant one. The trade one probably won't be a conversation until July when we figure out whether this team's going to be buying or maybe selling off a couple pieces. Jason from Markham asks, what's the story on Vogelbach's status? Was there a 45-day window? Are you stuck with him now? So players with his level of service time can sign what's called an advanced consent, which gives the team 45 days assent to outright them to the minors, and you're not on the hook for the full salary. We don't know. It hasn't been reported whether or not Vogelbach signed one of those advanced consents. His type of player just tends to generally, even if he had, that 45-day advanced consent would have expired by now. So unless he and the Jays worked out in a special deal that we're not aware of, then yeah, he's on the hook for that right now, although he wouldn't be the first guy making $2 million to get outrighted to the minors before. That's it. We'll try to get to some of those leftover questions later at a later show. Thanks to Jonah Bierenbaum for coming on. Thanks for the questions, everyone. Thanks to Amit Mann, Lance Kennedy, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Have a great day. Talk to you tomorrow.